in the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Everybody, welcome to Raging Chickens Out to Cube Live. Yes, it is our call-in show for Monday, January 11th, 2021. It is our first show of the new year. Too bad, I guess, we didn't have much to talk about this week, right? Holy crap. It's like just when you want to turn around and you want to say, see ya, 2020. Not nice knowing ya. We're greeted with a new year with full of insurrection. How about that? Well, on Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts from our own backyards and from across the country. On Fridays, and kind of our, you know, that was our kind of like our flagship show, I guess you should say. Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics, but you can get both our flagship Friday show and Out to Coop Live by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. But you can only join the conversation live through the Podbean app on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can also kind of check out our YouTube show. You can kind of follow us there. But only on the Podbean app do you get to kind of call in. If you've got some comments, you want to join the conversations and so on. pretty cool. And, you know, if you are subscribing to our podcast, once you get that's on iTunes or Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, and Spotify, make sure that you give us that five-star ranking. Five stars, you know, that helps other people find us, right? Get over there. If you're on our YouTube channel, make sure that you're subscribing to our YouTube channel. Make sure you hit that little bell for notifications every time we go live. All that actually helps kind of project this show out there and helps other people find us. So there you go. You can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month at patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show live on the Podbean app, you can always show us some love right now. You can drop a few bucks in our tip jar by clicking on that little gift icon at the bottom of your screen or your smartphone, I guess. You can fill your digital pockets with Podbean's golden beans and send us a gift of your choice. Every gift you send helps support and expand this podcast. And if you're looking for some more PA-based progressive talk, tune into the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter, Facebook, or, you know, while you're at it, subscribe to his daily podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And a special shout out to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at SongADayMan. That's at SongADay, M-A-N-N. It's two N's on that. His last name, Jonathan Mann with two N's. So at SongADayMan. He's got like that Guinness Book of World Records for writing, you know, the most consecutive days of songs. I don't think I'm saying that correctly, but he's got that. And he's always kind of got the political bent to him, and he's got some good stuff. Did a good one this week about Bernie Sanders, this kind of incoming budget chairman, incoming Chairman Sanders. So that's fun. Well, anyways, on today's show, thanks for kind of joining us tonight. I hope you had a good break, a nice holiday time, had some chance to spend some downtime away from work, maybe with some family, maybe not. Maybe, you know, everything's obviously downscaled a little bit this year. But if those of you, you might remember, if those of you have been listening to our regular show on Fridays, you might recall that right before Christmas, I was planning on doing a version of the show that I'm doing tonight. And the idea is that instead of trying to book a guest right before Christmas, that I would kind of take this opportunity to kind of, you know, talk about this question of civility, right, that keeps on coming up in our political discourse. And because I've written about it, because I'm an academic too, right? I teach at Kutztown University, and that's in Pennsylvania. I write on kind of social movements and rhetoric, and that's where I do my kind of primary research, and also in social media theory and strategy. So this is a piece that I wrote a while ago, and I thought it was a good opportunity to talk about it. But Christmas was coming up, you know, dealing with family stuff and everything. I said, you know what, let's just take a break. And then I started having some questions about, you know what, maybe we don't need to do this. Maybe I don't need to go back to it. It seemed less relevant. And then lo and behold, here we go. It starts off the first freaking, like, you know, open, like, you know, first main week of the year, there's an insurrection in the Capitol. So, you know, we can only hope that the rest of 2021 doesn't look like what we experienced this past week. You know, for the first time since 1814, that says during the War of 1812, the U.S. Capitol building was stormed by fanatical Trumpsters, QAnon conspiracy theorists, and white supremacists, and other right-wing radicals, in what was nothing less than an attempted coup. And that's exactly what Fiona Hill called it. You know, she was the former senior director of Trump's National Security Council. She's also was a kind of a star witness in his first impeachment hearing. But while the smell of the tear gas was like still strong in the Capitol, we already began to hear these calls of, you know, moving beyond, or let's move forward, or let's put that behind us. You know, and it just seemed weird to me. You know, and people were calling for this return to civility. Can't we all get along and so on? And look, I'm the last person that's going to sit here and say I don't think people should be nice to one another or something like they're civil. You know, like when I go to the grocery store, right, and you got a kind of a young, like a young worker, maybe just kind of first couple weeks on the job, and they're kind of put on bagging duty in the midst of the COVID pandemic, and they're having a tough time doing it, right? I think it's a good idea to kind of give that person some slack, right? To say, hey, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I get it, right? I've got time. Don't worry about it. Don't. I'm not upset, you know, and be kind to that person, right? Be civil to that person. Be civil to that, you know, that young worker who's trying to actually help you out, right? After all, we've been calling these folks frontline workers for so long, and, you know, these are the heroes of the pandemic, so we give them a slack. That's the kind of civility that I'm all about. Right. And I also am a big proponent of democracy. Right. You know, all of, you know, the research that I did in my, say, PhD and my graduate work and my writings, you know, about expanding, deepening democracy. And but something felt really off by, you know, like literally an hour after the people were finally driven from the Capitol building after, you know, at that point, four people were dead. Now, you know, then five people are dead. And now you have another Capitol Hill police officer who's dead from apparent suicide. Right. And to suggest that we just somehow move on and forget the past seemed like bonkers to me. It felt like a new version of kind of collective gaslighting that was going on. And it was like it really bugged me. Which brought me right back to this article that I'd written before. Anyways, we'll get to that. So, the other, oh, you know, yeah, you know the one that really got me? When people said, this is not the America we know. This is not the real America. I'm like, what are you talking about? For the vast majority of people, right, in this country, this has been the threat of America. For people around the world, right? I mean, you know, this whole idea about American exceptionalism was being used in real time to cover over this kind of like gross disparities and violence at the core of this country. So here we go. But then I have to say that night, you know, I was watching like, you know, going down, you know, doom scrolling and kind of watching the kind of news and going back and have multiple screens going about to find out what's going on. And MSNBC had a panel discussion about the insurrection, you know, that kind of real-time coverage and all this. And Chris Hayes was brought on, and Rachel Maddow was leading the coverage. And he basically put into words, the first time I saw like on mainstream media, right, them say kind of put into words what was kind of a version of what was going on in my head. And to kind of help set the tone a little bit for tonight, I want to just play you what he said. So hopefully the sound's going to come in up okay.
At one level, I understand, and I think it's admirable and correct and appropriate to proceed with business as usual to show that they are uncowed by the armed insurrectionists unleashed on the Capitol by the President of the United States, who has been plotting actively in public and in private sedition now for 8 weeks since he lost the presidential election. In order to not allow those people to cow them from doing their constitutional duty, reasserting normalcy is all well and appropriate. appropriate, but there is something, frankly, kind of appalling about the tone of normalcy that has resumed in the nation's capital on this evening, on a day in which we've seen the most severe threat to democratic sovereignty in the nation since the Civil War and the firing of the cannons of Fort Sumter. Exactly. I mean, what happened today, which is being treated, I think, as some kind of unpleasant episode, which we should get past to get upon and back on the right track of the nation's peaceful transition of power, strikes me as flirting with ignoring what happened and the pressing emergency that faces the nation right now, which is that the president of the United States is clearly a danger and threat to the republic and needs to be lawfully removed from office as fast as is legally practicable. To watch Ben Sasse speechify about shoveling your neighbor's snow, which is a good, nice thing to do, while the president retains control of the nuclear codes, having urged essentially his battalions of fascist thugs to storm the Capitol, is just very, very difficult to digest, I have to say.
Yeah, that's what he was, you know, and he's like, and I think he took the rest of his panel a little bit off guard. He's like, whoa, Chris. But I think he was spot on there. And, you know, the whole idea is like, this is a little bit, you know, hard to swallow, that we're all just going to kind of pretend that this is not going on. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've read enough history and learned about the, you know, the rise of fascism, the rise of kind of like autocracy and things like this. So like, you know, I was always saying you're not supposed to kind of like reward the people who are threatening to kind of destroy your culture, right? I mean, isn't that we're supposed to, I don't know. So anyways, that's kind of set the tone a little bit, kind of, and that would kind of echo to that. I know, I think, you know, again, you know, take Chris Hayes for what you will. I mean, I like Chris Hayes. I think he's good. You know, I don't always agree with him on a bunch of stuff. He tends to be a little bit in that kind of more of that kind of like, oh my God, kind of moral space that I tend to not be in quite as much. But still, I think that was a spot on point. And I cut him off there because the panel goes on and then it gets away from the point, real kind of important point he was trying to make. There was another guy, I forget his name, Ben Hill might be his name. He was interviewed on CNN just yesterday talking about the lead up to the events of January 6th, the right wing insurrection. And he was basically laying out, look, this shouldn't have been a surprise to anybody. This is what has been creeping for a long time. Right. And he's talked about what QAnon thought about and what these people were after. Right. So there's like, how can we not be paying attention to this stuff? Anyways, so I'm going to be kicking off the discussion tonight with an article I wrote back in 2018 about the breakdown of democracy in the lead up to the 2016 election. Now, and to be in all kind of honesty about this, this is an article that I originally wrote as part of a conference paper way back in, I believe it was 2011, actually, by the time we got to the conference. And it was specifically looking at the Tea Party, right? The rise of the Tea Party, who took over Congress in the 2010 midterm elections and moved mass austerity, you know, brought in the racism, was when we first started seeing, you know, like armed people show up with AR-15s to, you know, on demonstrations about healthcare. Like, you know, God forbid people have healthcare, so you got to water the tree of liberty with blood. You know, that's when this stuff got started. It's like, and then I was thinking about it, I'm like, holy shit, this is 10 years ago. And, you know, Sean and I, when we were doing a lot of writing in Raging Chicken, so if you go to RagingChickenPress.org, that's most of our writing, we followed the rise of these folks, both in Pennsylvania and around the country. And, you know, I'll tell you, we used to get messages all the time from, you know, people in kind of political circles and the liberals say, you know, you guys, you're giving them too much attention. You shouldn't pay attention to them, right? If you just ignore them, they'll go away. Right. The place that I work, Kutztown University, that's how we were told to deal with these kind of like right wing fascists that would come and religious fascists that would come on and then basically assault students. Right. And berate students about their sexuality and about their practices. And we were just told, just, you know, ignore them. They'll go away. And Sean and I, you know, again, we're not alone in this, but I'm saying on this show, in the little like world that I kind of am part of on a kind of regular basis, we've been pointing to this stuff and saying, this, we got to take this serious. Then when I was realizing this article that I was writing was 10 years old, right? And people were talking, were on TV, were talking about how they're surprised they were that was going on. Even after 4 years of Trump, I said, you know what? Why don't we try this out? Why don't we actually take a look at the article and I'll kind of walk you through a little of some of the, some of what I was trying to argue there. And this is something new. We haven't done this before in Out to Coop Live. They haven't done this at all. We were kind of doing like a little bit of reading and talking and then open discussion. But, you know, I figured, what the hell? It's a new year. We'll kind of roll with it. You can all let me know if, like, at the end of this, you're like, Jesus, man, this sucked. Whatever. You know, you can tell me. That's kind of what we're here for. That's the whole idea about this, you know, this interaction. You guys can always drop us a line, you know, at ragingchickenpress@gmail.com, you know. Comments here, comments on our, you know, on our podcast, all that stuff is always great. You know, anything you hear back from you is awesome. So the article that I wrote was called We Are Not All in This Together, A Case for Advocacy, Factionalism, and Making the Political Personal. And it's appeared in this amazing collection. I know on Podbean folks are not gonna be able to see it, but at least I'll hold it up for the people on YouTube. This amazing collection called Unruly Rhetorics. Get the camera right on that one. Unruly Rhetorics, Protest, Persuasion, and Publics. It was edited by Jonathan Alexander, Susan Jarrett, and Nancy Welch. And it's a phenomenal collection, right? I mean, for those, someone like me who looks at kind of social movements, politics, and rhetorics, this book just was phenomenal. But like any kind of, you know, point of academic publishing, is that, you know, one of the problems of academic publishing is that when you're putting together a collection like this, right, the time from putting the collection together, reaching out and kind of getting people that are willing to write for the collection, finding a publisher for the collection, having the edits go back and forth, right, changing up some directions, and then going to press is a long period of time. So this, you know, this publication, which came out, you know, like I said, in 2018, was the first drafts of that paper, you know, probably kind of came up 2016 or so. You know, and the editors are absolutely freaking amazing. So, but it was great. So anyways, that's a phenomenal book. Do check that out if you can. But so what I thought I would do is, again, in the spirit of trying new things in this kind of, you know, 2021 world that we're in now, let you know a little, read a little bit about this article that I wrote, this chapter for this book called We Are Not All in This Together, A Case for Advocacy, Factionalism, and Making the Political Personal. Talk you through a little bit of it. I'm obviously not going to read the whole thing, but just as a way of kind of laying down some ideas or concepts of what the hell is going on right now and why this kind of these rampant appeals for civility or just kind of like normalization or let's get back to the normal working of things is a really, it's not just like wrong, it's dangerous at this point. So here we go. All right, so this is the way it starts out. And remember, this is kind of 2018, and I'm looking that the original, we'll really focus on the period of the early Obama, so that's why you're gonna hear the dates on this one. So for many commentators and political observers, the 2008 presidential election marked a kind of watershed in the level of incivility in American politics. And there is little doubt that our socially mediated world has reinforced that perception. To bolster the point, one need only call to mind the infamous Tea Party town hall meetings on Obama's Affordable Care Act in the summer of 2009. The images of right-wing radicals strapped with AR-15s, waving banners proclaiming that it's time to water the tree of liberty with blood, or the overtly racist attacks on the first African-American president that were streamed daily on talk radio. Of course, the 2016 presidential election has made the incivility of 2008 election look almost quaint by comparison. It is useful to call, however, how much the 2008 presidential campaign signaled a break in political norms, a break that set the stage for 2016. As bad as the vitriol was during the 2008 campaign and the Obama administration, calls for a, quote, return to civility, or narratives about the, quote, decline of civility in the United States, quickly began to grate on my nerves, especially following the sweeping Tea Party victories in the 2010 elections. It was a strange feeling. I have long appealed to notions of civil discourse as an important aspect of fostering a critically democratic classroom. Civility, as I've understood it, is not simply about being polite or not offending anyone. Rather, civil discourse was part of an often contestatory democratic rhetorical practice that is integral to any deliberative process worth its name. I have often invoked Mary Louise Pratt's notion of contact zones in which, quote, no one is excluded and no one was safe, right, as that kind of critical engagement. Or Kenneth Burke's parlor dominated by vigorous and heated discussion as useful guiding metaphors for critical civic engagement. It felt odd to find myself increasingly agitated at hearing renewed calls for civility in print and online. Perhaps that nagging feeling was not so misplaced, though. As Nancy Welsh argues in the collection that I just referred to, civility has been a tool, has been used as a tool to constrain public participation that might contest the privatization project of neoliberalism. Right, so that's the kind of launch off, right? There's the kind of the beginning. And it's true, you know, in my classrooms, I teach writing, I teach, you know, composition. And one of my key things is like, look, the point here is not to try to tell me what I already believe, right? I know what I believe and I want to hear what I want to believe. I'm tired of hearing myself talk half the time, right? The point is to kind of engage from where you sit and take that risk of that engagement, but also be accountable to that engagement, to listen critically to others, as a way of kind of thinking through where the differences in where we stand, that kind of thing. And I really do believe that is the heart of, say, democratic culture. Anyways, there's this little piece, I'm not gonna read this part, but in the Obama administration, they had this document, it was called A Crucible Moment. And it was about colleges and universities. And frankly, I thought it was one of the best statements about what the importance of, say, critical civil discourse, right, for a democratic culture, right? And so this is a quote from the report: urged the higher education community to, quote, not only theorize about what education for democratic citizenship might require in a diverse society, but also to rehearse that citizenship daily in fertile, rolling contexts of pedagogic inquiry and hands-on experience, right? So that whole idea is you put your money where your mouth is, right? You can't just say that, you know, you're an institution of higher learning or higher education in part to educate future citizens, right? You actually have to behave like that. You have to provide spaces to practice that kind of discussion, right? Because democracy, after all, what is democracy? It's basically saying that we are no longer going to kill each other to resolve disputes. We are going to argue with each other. We are going to try to persuade one another. And then in the end, we're going to vote. And the majority, or supermajority in some cases, but the majority, right? That's what's going to win. And then everybody agrees that you're going to abide by the decision. Doesn't mean you're going to be happy with it. Doesn't mean there's a kumbaya moment. Doesn't mean you have to be friends with those people. But it means that that's the system, right? Instead of the battlefield, we've got the polis. We've got the congressional floor. We've got the House floor, right? That's the idea. So that crucible moment, that was the kind of report that would normally re-energize my commitment to democratic education, civil discourse, and the mission of higher education. Normally, it would have provided my next goal on a post to the Democratic horizon. Not this time around. What happened? One word. Wisconsin. I continue. The attacks on unions, working families, and the civil rights in Wisconsin. If a commitment to civil discourse and democracy is little more than a veneer in my little corner of academe, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's all-out assault on collective bargaining, the rights of working families, access to affordable health care, and the progressive democratic compact at the core of the state's progressive social history was the wrecking ball. At the beginning of 2011, Governor Walker introduced the now infamous budget repair bill, claiming that gutting union rights and public services was necessary to fix a significant budget crisis. Beginning in February 2011, a kind of political version of War of the Worlds, War of the Worlds, Walker's initial attack on public sector unions was like an activate signal sent to sleeper cells around the nation programmed to destroy unions and public institutions. In Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Idaho, and right here in Pennsylvania, the attacks came fast and they were unrelenting. For anyone who hadn't been paying attention to politics for a decade or so, Walker's raiders must have sent their heads spinning. However, for observers like Naomi Klein, this new assault on working families and the commons was a logical next step in what she calls disaster capitalism. Quote, orchestrated raids on the public sphere in the wake of catastrophic events combined with the treatment of disasters as exciting market opportunities. That's from Klein's shock doctrine. Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, documents how the proponents of free markets, followers of late University of Chicago economist Milton Friedman in particular, figured out how to make use of natural and manufactured crises to usher in undemocratic, radical free market policies. And there we sit. Right, so that's the kind of the legacy of kind of what brings us to where we are today. Right, that's that, and that was going on, if you notice there, right? That was 2010 that I'm referring to. That had been going on already for about 20, 30 years. Right, and there's been great books about that. We won't get into that right now. So here's the, this is the part that, so that's the context of this piece, and that's why I read that part. But here's the part in particular that I think motivates me tonight and wanted me to bring me to do this little show. So this is the largest chunk, and then we can kind of maybe open up the discussion a little bit, see what you all have to say if you want to give your reflections on what we're seeing right now, where to go, and this whole question about civility. But so this is under a section called Liberals Disciplining Bodies. And this is the thing that really I have to say. When I read this piece, this you'll hear me talk about Roger Hodge from Politico, I was livid. And it was probably that piece, in some ways more than anything, that just motivated me to write this thing. And I have to say, the first version of this that I gave at this conference in Philadelphia with my friend Seth and MJ Braun, we were down there as part of a conference. And I wish we recorded that session because it was one of the best engagements we've had. I think we shocked the audience in terms of what we were saying, but whatever. It is what it is. So anyways, here we go. In the wake of the Wisconsin uprising, liberals such as Roger Hodge, writing in Politico, urged fellow well-meaning folks to look to Federalist Papers co-signer and fourth U.S. President James Madison. Because, like, James Madison was somehow going to solve all our problems, right? Okay. Anyways, sorry, I'm commenting. Hodge made the case that an American left, right, that targeting the left here, this is a classic, you know, move of the liberal center. The American left was, quote, seemingly bereft of principles, unquote, should seek to reclaim Madison's notions of Republican liberty and principle that, quote, derives its energy from the will of society and thus acts in the larger public interest, not in the narrow interest of a particular faction, whether composed of planters or financiers, unquote. That's from Hodge. Yes, well-meaning for sure. Hodge closes his case with the following, quote, even in our unhappy political circumstances, most Americans retain a profound attachment to the Madisonian principles that were meant to animate our constitutional systems. We may yet discover the common ground on which to build a coherent, public-spirited opposition to narrow factionalism of our current two-party system, unquote. Hodge's critique of an American left, quote, bereft of principles, his longing for that common ground, his characterization of our current political circumstances as unhappy, his appeal to, quote, most Americans, and his use of the conditional may to hedge on a future common ground are all elements of a popular liberal sentiment with a founding fathers twist. However, this kind of response to an open war against working families did more to discipline those bodies sleeping on the marble floors of the Capitol in Madison and similar mobilizations than it did or does help reinstate political common ground. In my mind, the appeal to Madison's warning against factions in our current political environment is a philosophical luxury if the goal is to defend democracy. The founding father who seems more appropriate to our, quote, unhappy times is not James Madison. It's Thomas Paine. In Epistle to the Quakers, Thomas Paine forcefully responds to Quakers who were condemning colonists for taking up arms against England. Instead of taking up arms, the Quakers argued, the colonists should appeal to higher values and continue along the path of reason. Our plan is peace forever, wrote the Quakers. Paine wrote that the revolutionaries shared the Quakers' desire for peace. However, there was no possibility of such a peace while the colonies were still under British rule, and that's the key. And that meant direct confrontation. Quote, now this is Paine, we act consistently because for the sake of introducing an endless and interrupted peace, do we bear the evils and burdens of the present day? We are endeavoring and will steadily continue to endeavor to separate and dissolve a connection which has already filled our land with blood, and which, while the name of it remains, will be the fatal cause of future mischiefs in both countries. Unquote. Paine was recognizing, of course, that the English were not going to simply change their minds and suddenly see that peace was their ultimate interest. Right? You see this move happen all the time, right? When they say, like, you know, someday the, you know, this is the whole idea, is that, you know, the Republicans are going to wake up, right? And the fever's gonna break. That's the phrase, right? The fever's gonna break. They're like, oh my God, of course. Of course that's right. Of course this is what we should do. So at the same time, Paine was also suggesting that once England was denied its rule, the goal was to establish, quote, peace forever. Paine indicts the Quakers as helping England maintain its rule by choosing the people and only the people as the targets of their scorn. And this is a larger quote from Paine, and we're almost done with the part I'm going to read. Sorry. Alas, it seems by the particular tendency of some of your testimonies, talk to the Quakers again, and other parts of your contact, as if all sin was reduced to and comprehended in the act of bearing arms, and that by the people only. Ye appear to us to have mistaken party for conscience, because the general tenor of your actions wants uniformity, and it is exceedingly difficult to give credit to many of your pretended scruples, because we see them made by the same men who, in the very instance that they are exclaiming against the mammon of this world, are nevertheless hunting after it with every step as steady as time and an appetite as keen as death. He's basically saying here, like, this both-siderism's bullshit, right? You can't just say, like, okay, oh, look at this. Like, yes, England is coming around and, well, you know, they have armies and they're slaughtering people and they're kind of, you know, they're throwing them in jail and they're kind of all sorts of turmoil. And then you got these other people wanting to stand up with arms, and you're only going to condemn the people who are standing up. You're only going to condemn those people. Right. So he's calling them out, and he's like calling bullshit on them right there. Anyways, the message we should take from Paine is that acting in response to injustice, especially injustice that denies what Paine and the Founding Fathers saw as inalienable rights, is never pure. Idealism is for better times. Now, while Madison was warning against factionalism, Paine argued for factions. We are not all in this together. There are those people who are aligned with England who want to keep this a colony and suppress the people. Those needs, those desires are fundamentally opposed to the colonists who want their freedom from that tyranny, right? Okay. Paine saw the Quaker appeal to civil discourse and persuasion, to civility and Christian morality, as aiding and abetting England's continued rule of the colonies and filling the land with yet more blood. Now, I'm not arguing that the post-2008 or post-2016 election, perfect, or now post-2020 election for that matter, perfectly mirrors that of early America, but invoking the Founding Fathers in the midst of a political upheaval is rhetorically charged and calls for us to understand the moment through a particular lens. If we must play the Founding Fathers' game, then so be it. Hodge's appeal to Madison asks us to act in a particular way by framing a moment in American politics, a moment marked by occupations of state capitals, racist attacks upon the president, public attacks on workers' rights to organize, and the list goes on. Remember, this is during the Obama administration. That is a kind of breakdown of civility, or at least the high-minded ideals of Madison. Paine does not necessarily disagree with Madison about the ends. However, Paine makes the case that getting to this end has to go through a struggle for power. This struggle requires, of course, a high-minded ideological battle, of course. But for one set of ideas to triumph over another, there has to be a material confrontation, a battle that involves people putting their bodies on the lines. There is an important point to make, and this is the last part, to make regarding the distinction between civility as a strategy and civility as a tactic. Okay, so you got these two things. The democratic project relies on civility as a strategy. It rests upon privileging civil discourse as the means through which governing takes place. Once those rules are the game are established, civility becomes part of the democratic habitus. Right. So that's the whole idea. Right. Once we all agreed to those rules that we are no longer going to, you know, here's the set, you know, the set of the rules we're going to play by. And then instead of killing each other to settle disputes, we're going to play by the rules of democracy and civic discourse. We're going to argue. We're going to argue passionately. We have to marshal evidence in support of our claims. We get other people to try to persuade that, all that kind of stuff. Right. That's that idea. That's the strategy of civility instead of war. People then use civility tactically. However, the tactic civility requires the normalization of civility as a strategy. Put another way, in order for civility and civil discourse to be effective for managing a democracy, the people need to agree to the rules as a precondition to playing the game of self-rule. Madison is authoring the strategy of civil discourse that will call citizens to be tactically civil. His warning against factions provides us with a heads up for how a Republican democracy can fall apart. His hopes were to institute checks to the ability of factions to destroy a young constitutional democracy. However, as Payne reminds us, quote, seeking compromise or respecting the other side's opinions, unquote, as tactics are ineffective as tactics if the strategy of civility has broken down or is yet to be established. We have seen this dynamic play out in real time during the first terms of the Trump administration. Reaffirmation of the importance of civil discourse or appealing to the higher ideals of Republican democracy was not, and is not, going to bring about peace forever. The problem is that a faction has outsmarted, outorganized, and importantly, outspent Madison's constitutional protections. My point, then, is that calls for seeking common ground and civility and getting back to normal, as Hodge and many other liberals have made, in the face of a well-funded, systematic factional attack, is like showing up to a gunfight with thank you cards. The post-Obama era requires Payne-like thinking. So that's a piece. I mean, there's tons more in this piece that I could go into, but that's just it. And I know I hate sitting here and kind of reading at you like that. I apologize for it. But it's the only way I could kind of like focus my head in some ways around what just happened this week. What complicates this now is that, you know, I was rereading this article in preparation for tonight and so on. One of the things that I realize that, you know, this happens so often is that you've got this rhetoric and you've got these ideas that come out of the left, the progressives, the radical left, the left, you know, that are looking to kind of like expand democracy, that the very like icons and individuals that are so important to that legacy, like Thomas Paine, have been repackaged and reappropriated now. Right. And utilized by the radical right. Right. It is mind bending to me. Right. Because I had somebody say to me the other day, you know, yeah, but Thomas Paine calling for factions. But, you know, that's what they just did in the Capitol. Right. So, but you got to be able to. I swear to God, we got to be able to make some distinctions here. Right. The idea that what we're talking about, what Thomas Paine was arguing about, is the struggle for democracy, of self-rule, right? Of justice. You know, Paine went much farther than the Founding Fathers and talk about economic justice and economic equality, right? I mean, Paine in some ways is like in that tradition of American socialism. Not saying he was a socialist, right? We can argue that back and forth, but I'm just saying he's in that tradition. And now to see someone like Thomas Paine being appropriated by the radical right is mind-bending. And, you know, to see Thomas Jefferson, for that matter, I mean, again, Thomas Jefferson, not saying he's a saint, but, you know, he did say a couple things, you know, this whole idea about having a revolution every several years, right? The idea that you cannot allow entrenched control, entrenched power by any group, that would lead to an erosion of democracy, an erosion of freedom. And at the same time, we see these Tea Party flags come out. We see this whole idea about, you know, using Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson argues about a revolution as basically saying, you know, Thomas Jefferson basically was also saying that, yes, you can't allow the concentration of power in the government, but you also cannot allow it, the concentration in the hands of corporations, of business, of the moneyed elite. And instead, you've got, you know, a 40-year project on the part of the radical right, you know, that extends, you know, all, you know, through the Koch brothers going, I mean, we can run that. We've, you know, go back and listen to some of our shows about this. And you know, these kind of radical libertarians taking up this, the mantle of like, you know, we want small government while doing everything in their, you know, in their power to support the massive consolidation of power under corporations in this country. It's astounding to me. And, you know, to quote Malcolm X, you know, I mean, he's in a different context, but what we saw this week in some degree are the chickens coming home to roost. I mean, the Republican Party in this country, the right wing in this country, the billionaire dark money funders of the radical right in this country have been playing with fire for decades. They have been funding the rise of racism, the rise of anti-immigration. They've been funding white supremacy and the rise of white nationalism. And the Republican Party has been like, yeah, we want to give those, you know, those dog whistles to get those people ramped up. Because we need them to come out and vote for us every once in a while. Because guess what? The Republican Party represents a minority of the people in this country. Why do you think that, you know, the last three Republican presidents in this country have been elected by a minority vote of the popular vote? Joe Biden just won a landslide in the popular vote. He beat Barack Obama's numbers, like, which is astounding to me, because that was a huge turnout election. But because of the Electoral College and how that benefits the Republicans and how that benefits this faction that has been ruling our politics for so long, because of that, they know, those Republicans know, they are not a majority party. They are a white identity party. And that white identity, those, and you know, they have to kind of say, we need a larger share of them white folks to come and vote for us. And so we'll take the racist, sure. We're going to put on a veneer of civility. We're going to put on a veneer of, like, respectability. But really what we're doing the dog whistle racism stuff. It's the same freaking long history of white supremacy in this country that has motivated things for so long. I remember the guy's name, just to think about this. Watching the Majority Report the other day, and Rick Perlstein was on. And Rick Perlstein has, you know, he's got at least four books charting the kind of rise of the right from, you know, way back in kind of Barry Goldwater's time. And these books are phenomenal. You gotta, you know, check it out. I'll try to remember to put a link in the show notes too. But check out that interview he does with Rick Perlstein. I think it was yesterday's show or 2 days ago. It must have been Thursday of last week. I'm sorry. I can't even keep my days straight anymore. But, and you know, he talks about this. He talks about this. This is America, right? Like it or not, if that makes you uncomfortable or not, this is America. And we got to get our heads around that stuff. When we see moves of what happened after this, I mean, I don't know if you read any of the articles about these kind of play-by-plays or, you know, moment-by-moment accounts of what actually happened on the ground. Washington Post had an excellent one on it. There was a, what's this one? The Intercept had a great piece by Mike Giglio. I have a couple of these things around here. There's a great piece in... just dropped it. What was it? It was Masha Gessen writing in... what is she writing in? New Yorker. Right. And there was this, the piece in the Washington Post was the one that really got me. And the one in political too, the one that got me, where they're just saying how close we actually were for there being multiple deaths. I mean, there's, you've probably seen this guy now. There's that one scene where there's these folks break into the Capitol. They're rushing up the stairs. There's one cop. He's an African-American Capitol Hill policeman. Right. He's sitting there and he's, he's got this little, you know, expanded, like, you know, baton. And he's like, trying to keep him back, and then they chase him up the stairs, and he's yelling at them. He chases him up the stairs, and he gets to the top of the stairs, and he makes a left, and the crowd follows him left. In this account for the Washington Post and Politico, they're saying if that crowd had gone right instead of left, they would have been right outside the Senate doors, and on the other side of those doors, and they weren't fully barricaded yet. On the other side of those doors were armed Capitol Hill police officers, one with a semi-automatic weapon. If those people went to that room to go in there and try to arrest and kidnap members of Congress, it would have been a much bigger bloodbath. This is a problem. And if you have one group of people, the mainstream of the elected Republican majority, soon to be minority, if they are aiding and abetting right-wing insurrection and personal threats to lawmakers and to attempt a coup, those are not people that you meet in some middle ground. Those are the people that you expunge from the society. Sean and I have been talking for a long time now in our regular podcast about how it's time to end the Republican Party as it stands. Is, you know, and for Democrats who come out and say, now why can't we all get along? That is not where we need to be. The time we need to be in right now is the moment for bold agenda and fast action. If there are Republicans who are fed up with that too as well, we can leave a door open for them. That's fine. They can come right in. We're welcome. Welcome in. But you know what? We're not going to do the work for you. Right? And so those lawmakers, those Democrats like Chris Coons, like Joe Manchin, who come out and they tell CNN and things like this, they say, hey, you know what? I know what they say publicly, but, you know, in private conversations with my Republican friends, they're really concerned about this. Well, you know what? You don't get to have private conversations. Sam Cedar's been arguing this in the Majority Report for a while, too, as well. You don't, whatever. I'm not going to carry water for them because they feel this way. If they feel that way, they got to say it publicly. Otherwise, they are aiding and abetting. They are co-conspirators in the rise of fascism in this attempted coup. And that is horrible stuff. So when I look at that whole idea about civility, right, when we need to kind of think about this, I am not calling that we should somehow have some sort of armed erection. Insurrection ourselves, right? Or we should kind of launch into some civil war. I am not saying that. What I'm saying is that we have to say, number one, those people on the other side, the Republicans right now, as they're constituted, are not the friends of democracy. That if we want this democracy, we have to act boldly and swiftly now. And that is going to mean putting as much pressure on Joe Biden and the incoming administration to not kowtow to austerity. There's good news out on that today. Not to kind of like try to appease everybody. People are hurting. There's freaking over, 360,000 people dead because of the inaction on this coronavirus. You've got people who've lost their job. The unemployment numbers are off. Like, I don't know about you, but I know people that they're like, I know that they're standing in soup kitchen lines now. The number of people who are hungry, the number of children who are hungry is going through the roof. And it's not just Trump. I'm sorry. But for those folks who say Trump bad man, as we've been talking about incessantly on our podcast, it's not just Trump bad man. Trump could have been stopped. And guess who had the power to do it? The Republican Party. They didn't. Did they do it? No. And if you look at our state of Pennsylvania here, it's like off the charts. If you had Republican lawmakers who like packed up buses, right? Funded buses to go down to that insurrection, right? Who have like been helping fan the flames of racism and white supremacy in this state. I mean, this is a problem. And this is not the time that we get to sit on our laurels. I mean, look, I'm glad I had a freaking holiday for a few days because I don't think I realized how depressed and exhausted I was until I took a little break. And I dare I say I'm seeing a little more clear-eyed at this point. And, my kids are asking me questions about this, and I've got a 12-year-old and I've got a 9-year-old. And I'm thinking about their future as much as I'm thinking about mine. And there's no way we can allow this to happen. We have to nip this shit right now. That means those lawmakers who aided and abetted this and fanned these flames, they need to be removed from office at the state level and state by state across this country and at the federal level. That means that we need $2,000 checks immediately as soon as Biden takes office. That means, I'm going to leave this whole impeachment thing for another day, simply because it's a whole other lane to go down that I just really don't want to go down right now. There needs to be accountability. There needs to be, you know, prosecution. There can't be just like what they did with Nixon and say, well, we're just going to pardon the dude and we're going to move on because we need to move forward. No. What happened when the criminals, right, when the war criminals of the Bush administration weren't prosecuted, weren't held accountable? Well, we got the longest wars in our histories. We got a torture memo that was kind of like still with us today. There has to be accountability here. If we are a nation or a state worth our name and call ourselves a democracy, there needs to be accountability for those who would drive it asunder. Ooh, that's quite a way to start off the year, I have to say. Well, I know I went longer, a little bit longer than I wanted to for today, but, you know, for some reason, I'm seeing that I'm supposed to have messages coming up, but my messages are not showing up here. So, let's see. But basically what I want to say, so look, if any of you out there, if you got something to say, you got kind of thoughts about what happened over this last week, doesn't have to be just what I was just talking about, but just kind of reflections on what just took place this past week, this insurrection. You can hit that little call-in button at the bottom of the screen. And I'd love to hear what you got to say. I mean, I'd love to hear your perspective on things. While we take that little break to see if anybody would like to kind of join in here, want to remind you that you can help support this show by becoming a patron for those $5 a month, going to patreon.com/rcpress. Or if you listen to the Podbean app right now, you can hit that little gift icon at the bottom of your screen and send us a virtual cup of coffee, you know, some roses. They have a whole bunch of little things you can send. Every gift that you send helps support this podcast and extend it. I also wanted to say, I forgot to mention this really at the beginning, at the top of the show, but if you join the podcast now, if you become a patron for a little $5 a month now through the end of January, we've got a couple little gifts that we'll send you. So I've got these, you know, again, you're not gonna be able to see them if you're listening here on the Podbean app, but for those of you on YouTube page, we've got two little books, right? And I'm glad the left is starting to put out books like this again. But if you become a patron for those $5 a month, you get your choice as a kind of thank you gift. There's this book here, Timothy Snyder's On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. This is a phenomenal book, and it's kind of a little go-to book for what's been happening over the past 4 years, especially. Or if you don't like that one on tyranny, we've got Michael Brooks. You remember Michael Brooks was on the Majority Report, and he passed away this year. He was another huge loss to all of us. But he did publish a book before he passed on. It's like Against the Web, The Cosmopolitan Answer to the New Right. So if you become a patron for $5 a month at kind of either of these levels, or $5 a month or more, I'll send you one of these things. I'll let you know. And I want to remind you, if you're listening to us on our YouTube, if you get on over to our YouTube, make sure you're subscribing to the YouTube, to our YouTube channel. Make sure you hit that little bell. Basically says ding every time we go live. You get a little notification so you never miss it. There we have it. So I'm just trying to think about where we go here. I'm always curious about what you all think out there. You want to drop stuff down in the comments. You got any comments you want to drop down? If you want to kind of call in, it'd be great. we've got Brian, he's coming down on YouTube. He's basically saying, so does that mean programs to limit inequality as Aristotle recommended in a democratic society? Hell yeah. I mean, look, if I had my druthers, you start from the beginning. Okay, look, this is my free advice, right? You know, one of these days I should just like bite the bullet and try to make a go at this and basically tell people to pay me for this stuff. But this is my free political consultant work, okay? My free political consultant work says this. You start out right now and you say, Joe Biden, right? You're coming up here. What do you do there during that first week? Well, this is what you say. You come out and you say, I had every intention of beginning this administration by bringing us together and finding out where the common ground was. However, after the events of this past week, it seemed we have a lot more work that we have to do. That insurrection was birthed in decades of people being left behind, in decades of us favoring big business over the everyday individual. That has to do with decades of unaddressed systemic racism. That has to do with decades and centuries of unaddressed sexism and inequality. And we will never, ever get to where we need to go unless we address those. Therefore, I am here today going to propose what some have called a Green New Deal, but we're going to call Restoring America, whatever, something like that. And if you look at what the Green New Deal calls for, right? Or, you know, he could probably package it in the pandemic at this point, because frankly, all this stuff is connected at this point, right? Package that stuff together and basically say, we're going to give, what you name it, right? One, expand union rights. Two, federal jobs programs to help build out the infrastructure. Three, right? A $20 minimum wage, you name it, right? Not this freaking $15. That was $15 minimum wage. That was good 10 years ago. We need a $20 minimum wage. We need to stop the burning of fossil fuels and expand and invest in building out the kind of renewable infrastructure. And that means that as we shut down the coal plants, we are really building up those institutions in West Virginia. I was saying this to on our podcast on Friday. If I was Biden, or Bernie Sanders for that matter, head of the budget, budget committee now, I would be in West Virginia putting pressure on Joe Manchin, basically saying, this is where we are going to build a Green New Deal in West Virginia. Be going to those coal towns in Kentucky, right in freaking Mitch McConnell's face. This is where we're going to be. But you know what? Your senator does not want those jobs here. Your senator wants to send you back to the black lung holes of the earth. We want to build sustainable jobs and we want it to start here, but you are going to have to do the work of getting them out and getting them out of the way. You go to those areas of Pennsylvania, right, that have been forced into a situation where they've had to build pipelines and have their water destroyed so that they can have good jobs. And you say, this is where we start the Green New Deal. I mean, this is not brain surgery. The Democrats have the initiative if they want to take it. We got a message from Shanna here too as well. On said that Scott Perry has issued a if those of you who are outside of Pennsylvania that don't know who Scott Perry is, do read up on him. He's a scumbag in central Pennsylvania. Scott Perry issued a statement today to those calling for him to resign, because there have been several folks who have been calling for him, among others, to resign. Mastriano is a guy who's going to run for governor of the Republican Party. He was one of the, pictured happily down in front of the Capitol stoking the flames. Anyways, but Cumberland County saw over 140 vote changes their voter. Oh, yeah, I saw this. This is a great point. So here's a perfect example. Cumberland County, there's some stories in the local papers out in Cumberland County about how the election offices were flooded with calls, like unusually. Like this time of year, you don't get flooded with calls, but primarily from Republicans who are asking how they get to change their voter registration because they don't want to be Republicans anymore. That shows you what just happened. This is the point for initiative. And you know what's not going to work? It's not the Democrats pretending that the Republicans, nicer Republicans, that's not going to work. People need to see a vision now. Because the only vision they've got right now is being dominated by the freaking dark web and the QAnon folks. And it's a vision that is completely disconnected from reality. If we can't provide a counter vision that is about hope, that is about possibility, is about equity, is about ending white supremacy, about expanding out the lives and kind of investing in working families, working people, is about building out an economy that works for everyone. I mean, God, it's all like freaking Bernie Sanders quotes right now, but there's a reason why. That's where we go. And if we don't do that, and if we try to go back to this normal by all kind of being civil to one another and assume that the problem is the windows need cleaning as opposed to cleaning out the rot in the foundation, it's going to collapse. I mean, these people are already planning another round of like takeovers and assaults in state capitol buildings now. I will not be surprised if you start hearing media stories now about how people are being kind of asked to leave their, empty their offices in state capitol buildings around the country because there's been threats. This is going to happen unless we chart a strong vision delta and have zero tolerance for this kind of nonsense. The fact that nobody was ever held accountable for taking AR-15s inside state capitol buildings, if it was against the law, for example. The fact that there was a plot to kidnap, I can't believe I'm laughing about this, but to kidnap the governor of Michigan. Right? And for that matter, it was almost the exact same playbook that they had for Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi. And it was just literally minutes away from that being a reality. Ooh, Chad Wolf resigned. Yeah, he sucks. That is true. But yeah, we don't have a head of DHS right now. I can't even freaking believe this. I did not see that. So here we go, folks. This is, you know, it's the old union move, right? Which side are you on? This is why I think this is the Thomas Paine moment, right? The Thomas Paine moment to defend democracy with everything we've got, to be insistent upon expanding democracy and have an intolerance for white supremacy, of sexism, of the abuse of the working class. It is a time for factionalism, indeed. We are not all in this together, as was clearly demonstrated. I don't know if you heard this, but when Donald Trump called in to the RNC after the siege on the Capitol, he called in, there was a meeting of the RNC, he called into that meeting, and he got cheers and applause from the national RNC. There was just a poll that came out. I was reading this to my to members of my family over the weekend. This is the dark cloud that I am in my family, right? It was. I wish I had the figures right here, but it was like 35% of Republicans approved of the assault on the Capitol. Not approved of Donald Trump. Approved of the assault on the Capitol, even though five people lost their lives. They built a freaking gallows outside of that, and a guy with zip ties was going in looking for lawmakers to bring out and try publicly. We are not all in this together, and when 35% of Republicans say they approve of the assault on the Capitol, we've got a problem. And a majority of those Republicans believe that Joe Biden stole the election and the election was fraudulent. We are not in this together. We don't even have the same facts. And if the Democrats decide that they're going to play Monopoly in this lopsided way, you know, it's like this is what it's been for the past, like, how many years now? Since Obama, since 2008. The Democrats said, okay, let's read the rules of the game. We're going to play Monopoly. Okay, we go around, we collect $200. You know the game, right? Republicans turn, they say, oh, you owe me $200. And they say, why? And they say, because we say so. Well, that's not in the rules. They say, well, that's too bad. Oh, by the way, your next turn is forfeited. I get two turns of your one turn. The Democrats say, wait, no, that's not fair. Republicans say, well, we're going to do it anyways. Republican rolls an eight. He said, an eight. Oh, I go right to go and I collect $200. Matter of fact, I double that to $400. And Democrats say, no, you're not playing by the rules. And they whine and they complain. They're not playing the same game. And just say, you know, standing up and stopping your feet and saying you got to follow the rules when the other side just cares about power, it's not going to work. Brian says, can the Dem leadership do this, though? Schumer and Pelosi are classic minority party leaders, always arguing while on the back foot. Doesn't this moment require a younger, more strident leadership like AOC, Rashida Tlaib, or, you know, absolutely. Katie Porter, yes, absolutely, 100%. The fact of the matter is this, right? This is who we've got right this second, right? So, I mean, all the pressure in the world. Look, I mean, there is not time. If anything that we've learned from the Obama administration is that you can't like mess around when you've got all three. You've got the Senate, you've got the House, and you've got the presidency. You've got to move fast and you've got to move quick. As part of that, absolutely has got to be about shifting over the leadership. But you've got AOC. Look, she is a pretty freaking on point political analyst, and she understands where things are at. And she was saying, look, we don't have somebody who's ready to step up at this point. If somebody comes forward and we think then we're going to do it. But yes, Pelosi's got to go. Schumer is trying to put on a show, but he's got to go. But we got to be clear about this. We got to be absolutely freaking crystal clear about what we're doing here. People are dying. We have a botched vaccine rollout that's going on right now. People have lost their jobs and they're out of money. We need to respond vigorously and relentlessly to make sure people are taken care of. If we don't go out immediately, if the Democrats don't go out immediately and say, boom, $2,000 checks, they don't build back that trust, that this QAnon crap is going to take over once again. And we're going to find the same thing that happened with Obama. We get mired in this BS while you're waiting around to kind of like the good faith Republicans to show up. They're not going to. The only ones who are going to save us is ourselves. That means that as those of us who are not in elected like officials, those of us who are whatever, got a big mouth and talk on podcasts, people who have organized in their unions, who organize in the streets as part of the Women's March, who have organized as part of Indivisible, who have organized as part of DSA, who are organizing the streets and building grassroots power. And here in Pennsylvania, the PA stands up. That's our job, to put all the pressure we can upon these elected officials, to basically to walk and chew gum, to say, number one, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, we need this aggressive agenda. Joe Biden, we need this aggressive agenda, and we need new leadership. Both and. That would be my call. Oh, boy. We shall see. If anybody else has got any things they want to kind of throw in for the evening, please do. I'm looking at our time, and we're running a little past our time, but I don't know, Gus. I needed to be in this space. And, you know, I have to say, one of the, I don't know. I'll close with story time, I guess, unless you've got some, you know, I'll gladly take, you know, calls from you or for comments for you all here. But the last several years has been incredibly disheartening for me in my career. I was one of the people that got into higher education because I believed in the mission of higher education. I believed that we were educating students for the future as democratic citizens. Yes, for jobs and that stuff too. That's always going to be part of it. But really to build out, to create those kind of critical citizens. And I've worked now at a university that has done its best to break me. And I don't mean targeting me specifically, although there's been those times too. But I mean the relentless pursuit of, I don't even know what to call it. It's not even a pursuit. It's a relentless pursuit of destruction, really. About turning what was a gem, the word system that I work in, the state system of higher education in Pennsylvania, which is a gem, like a system that's whole mission was to provide access to working families in places that wouldn't normally get access to public higher education. That's like the cornerstone, right? The mission of the university is to ensure that there's places for everybody to go. And slowly but sure, Republicans and Democrats over the years have bled the system dry. They've defunded it. They've cut taxes and defunded it and cut the funding of the state system of higher education. To more and more, the burden has been shifted on students and their families to the point where Pennsylvania has the second highest rate of student debt in the country. And then they sink hundreds of thousands of dollars into PR campaigns about, it's good to be golden at Kutztown University, my university. They build like spectacular gyms and workout stations and swimming pools and luxury dorms to attract new students, all the while cutting faculty and basically telling us, giving us that impression that they really could give a shit about what we have to say. We've devoted our lives to this stuff and they really don't give a shit. Unless we're willing to be tools for them. If we're willing to be tools for the administration, oh man, they love us. Those faculty are right up top. This kind of discussion, this kind of, you know, I mean, I recognize that this has been a mostly a one-way discussion tonight. I recognize. But the idea that we could have spaces like this where we can talk openly about ideas, you know, I mean, that seems like it's been destroyed in so much of higher education. And it's depressing. And so, you know, I feel it is such a privilege to be able to have this space right here. You know, this podcast, to be able to kind of have the privilege, really, to kind of run this podcast, both this Out the Coop Live one on Mondays and our flagship show on Fridays. Because it's one of the spaces that, you know, which I think, you know, I think we need, not just this one, but other ones like this. We need to build out networks like this. We need, as a progressive community, to support each other. Right. I mean, the right wing was able to do this because they had billionaires, right? They kind of sank billions of dollars into right wing think tanks. They supported their intellectuals. They kind of supported publishing houses to publish their books. They supported their media empire, right? They didn't just kind of sit around and say, let me see your credentials and let me look at your pedigree and let me see what, you know, like what, where your PhD is from in order to determine whether or not, you know, you're the right person for the job. No, you know what the right did? The right wing, what they did is they funded like 10 different places. You got a great idea for that? We're going to fund all 10 of you. Some of you are not going to last, right? But we're going to give everyone the shot. You're going to spread it around. That's what we need to do, right? We need to really think about stepping up and supporting our progressive infrastructure, stepping up and support organizations like PA Stand Up, like DSA. I mean, I don't know wherever state you're in. I mean, I'm sure you've got organizations like that, grassroots-based organizations. Brian writes, so you think that the Capitol attack, even though penetrated by the right, will come back to hurt center-left and left organizers when they get folks out into the streets? Well, that's the concern. This is something I didn't talk about tonight, but I think, you know, there is a lot of room for caution here. I'm very concerned, like, as much as, I don't know if people saw this, but Biden came out today and basically said they're prepared at this point, right? Somebody's gotten to them. They're prepared at this point to actually spend trillions of dollars in the response to the coronavirus, like it emergency and so on. Hey again. Oh, Lightbright, you're back again. What's up? Oh, that's Ash Love. Sorry, you're saying hi to all. Gotcha. Sorry, my bad. I'm trying to follow two different screens here. But so anyway, so the idea here is my concern is that while Biden, on the one hand, seems to want to invest in that kind of in that spending that's actually going to get us out of this, it's going to give people money, it's going to make sure they're not thrown out onto the streets and evicted from their from their homes, to make sure that kids got childcare or healthcare, make sure the vaccine has got rolled out, make sure small businesses don't go under, all that stuff. It looks like they're prepared to do this, and I have some ideas about that plan, but I'm not sure. David Dayan did a great interview today on Majority Report again. And by the way, I've been plugging this every single time that I get a chance to. If you go to the American Prospects main site, American Prospect has a tab. It's called the Day One Agenda. I think I actually have it bookmarked here. I'll let you know what it is right this second. The Day One Agenda. Day One Agenda is if you just go to prospect.org/Day One Agenda. That's prospect.org/Day One Agenda. I'm just going to drop it here in the comments. It's here. I'm going to throw it in both YouTube and there. They've actually shown what can be done even without the Senate, without the Congress, right? Through simply the enforcing of the rules that are already on the books. You're in the wrong room. Sorry, Ash. Anyway, so there we've got. My point. Yeah. The point was this. The point was that at the same time that we saw that happening, Biden was also calling for, say, new kind of either legislation or laws about domestic terrorism. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm really concerned about. Is we don't need new laws at this point, right? These are people, there's laws in the books already that can deal with people seeking to overthrow the government, okay? We don't need new laws. The last thing in the world that we want to do is actually to say that, okay, anything that looks like what we saw today, we're just going to call it terrorism. We're going to apply the full force of the American military to do that. No. Right? We need to be able to make distinctions between, so for example, when you've got the occupation of the Capitol building in Wisconsin after the budget repair bill, which I talked about in that piece that I read earlier on, right? That kind of occupation, that kind of direct action, that needs to be protected, especially in public spaces, right? Even if it's people that I don't agree with, right? The occupation, nonviolent protest needs to be protected. Right? What happened on the 6th was not that. Those were people that were calling for the lynching of the vice president, of Nancy Pelosi, a whole series of other people. They were calling for the overthrow of an election to support the strongman in power. That is anti-democratic. That is the exact thing that you do not want to conflate. Like, we have no room for both siderisms at this point right now. We do not need a bigger police state to handle this. What we need is some clarity about who the enemy is. Again, the faction. Which side are we on? Are we the side of protecting democracy, or are we on the side of the QAnon conspiratists who want the kind of authoritarian rule by God, you know, whatever, demigod Trump, or whoever the hell is going to be the next one, right? That's the deal. That's the deal. So, yes, I am concerned. I am concerned that, you know, especially you've got these kind of law and order Democrats who, you know, want to see like they're strong against, you know, on law and order, so that they're going to be willing to throw BLM, Black Lives Matter protesters, under the bus, right? Because they don't want to kind of be seen as, you know, having a position, which is insane, right? I mean, which is insane. If you're in politics and you want to pretend you have no position, I mean, well, that has been the Democratic Party for the bulk of, you know, the past 30 years or so. But still, no, that is not the time for this. I am concerned about that. But that means, guess what? There's people like, you know, Brian, like you, like people like me, people like who have a space in the public, when it becomes our obligation to make those distinctions and those arguments publicly, to provide the language and the discourse by which to make those separations and those things distinct, to say why QAnon right-wing kind of like insurrectionists are different, right, and distinct from Black Lives Matter protesters. Their aims are different. Their tactics are different. Then we need to put pressure on the media to exacerbate and show those differences. Why it is saying that I want police to stop killing our communities is different than saying we want to lynch our elected representatives. Those are different things, right? This is not even hard, I swear to God. And it's like, I'm laughing only because it takes so much work to make this hard. Like, I mean, this should be just common sense, people able to see those distinctions. But for too long, I'm telling you, this is where the Democrats, they've got to change their direction, because for too long, they've been trying to conflate this stuff. This is what Bill Clinton did, right? He got raised above us because he triangulated everybody and took over Republican discourse, right? That's what he did back in the 90s. It was Bill Clinton that deregulated the FCC and allowed, like, set the tone for these freaking right-wing media conglomerates to rise and take over our airways. Because he wanted to see, like, free reign. The age of big government is over. That was Clinton. Clinton finished the Reagan agenda. Clinton was tough on crime. That's where the crime bill came from. None of that. We got to get We got to run from that shit. So, I don't know. Shannon says, really alarmed but not entirely surprised by how many PA cops were there Wednesday. Yeah, it's true. Including in her own little township. Wonder where we support our police folks are being holding them accountable. I mean, there was actually people down there. I mean, how they were attacking police too as well. So here you have, like, now even within police departments, there's the question of, like, you know, are you a good cop or are you a bad cop according to the QAnon folks, you know? There's even that picture of the one cop was dragged from one of the archways of the Capitol and beaten with a flagpole with the American flag from it. Another guy taking his Blue Lives Matter flag, which he brought to the protest, and tearing it up in front of the cops and saying, you're fascists, you're traitors. All right, so there's that. And there's more and more reporting. You watch what happens over the next couple of weeks. I've seen some of these kind of early reports, and there's the number of ex-military and either ex-police or off-duty police officers who were there as part of the insurrection is, exactly as Shannon said, is really remarkable. There were a couple younger officers, Capitol Police officers, who were interviewed. I forget which one it was. I want to say it was a Politico article, but I'm not sure about that. They were African-American officers, and they had only been in the Capitol Hill Police for a few years, and basically came out and said, look, those people who charged in the Capitol building, the insurrectionists, basically calling them the N-word, call them all these racist words. And they said they were, you know, again, they're being somewhat diplomatic, saying they're incredibly disappointed to see the reaction to a lot of their white colleagues. In other words, the white Capitol Hill police who were taking selfies, as I guess two Capitol police were suspended today, Shanna said, including the selfie guy. There are other folks who were opening the gates and allow other people coming in. There was great footage of watching some police basically saying, yeah, sure, come on in. No, don't come in. No, come in. No, don't come in. Sure, you want to come in. You're not supposed to be in here, but you got to walk by. And basically calling them out and basically saying, yes, it's not just a perceived double standard between how the police respond to the Black Lives Matter protesters and how they respond to kind of right-wing insurrectionists. It's an actual one, right? You know, they're saying, no, it's real. It's not just your reading of things. Some sort of bizarre postmodern world. Yes, I agree, Brian. It is true. The whole generation of Dems, right? They were part of rebranding the Dems so that they could win against Republicans, and they went our light. Yeah, it's true. They believed that, you know, America was a conservative thing, so they needed to kind of follow the conservatives. Yes, that's right. A whole generation. And those are the people that need to be out of power. Right? This is where the baby boomers need to go. I'm sorry. Right. You know, as a Gen Xer, right, I can't tell you how freaking happy I am that there's millennials and there's the Generation Z out there now. Right. You know, we didn't have the numbers, man. We tried. A lot of us have been fighting for a long time, but the baby boomers have just freaking overshadowed and dominated everything and making virtually no space for people to enter. And now, man, you all young folks have got the numbers and you've got the mentality, you've got the energy, you've got the, you know, just the freaking will. So anyways, listen, I'm looking at the clock here and I think I'm gonna have to start to wind things down tonight. I got two kids, I gotta get to bed. as it goes. But listen, a couple things. One, got to say it again and say, you know, if you could find in your heart to kind of become a member of this show, become a patron of Raging Chicken, if you haven't already. I know there's some folks that are on tonight who've been supporting us for a while. Thank you so much. I can't even tell you how encouraging it is to keep me going. But you can become a patron by going to patreon.com/rcpress. You can become a patron for as little as $5 a month. And if you become a new patron to the end of the month, end of January, we've got your choice of On Tyranny by Timothy Snyder. We can send that to you, 20 Lessons for the 20th Century. Or Against the Web, A Cosmopolitan Answer to the New Right by Michael Brooks, the late Michael Brooks. We'll send you as a little thank you gift. That's at patreon.com/rcpress, becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. I also want to say that next Monday, we're going to shift gears a little bit, unless there's another, you know, who the hell knows what's going to happen in the next week. But the plan is for next Monday night, we're going to have some student activists come on from KU Student Activists. These are students from Kutztown University who have been doing some amazing activist work. It's been amazing watching this group evolve. And as you're getting ready to head back to campus, head back for the spring semester, the president of Kutztown University has now also tested positive for COVID-19. I mean, he's been the kind of like, you know, grit and fortitude dude. Everybody's got to come back to in-person learning. Like, screw the virus. You just got to have grit and fortitude. Well, he's got it now. But these activists have been doing some amazing work in terms of building solidarity with communities and solidarity with parents, solidarity with workers. And we've got three of them that could come on next week, and we're gonna have a little discussion about, say, back to school in the pandemic and kind of where things go, and the kind of connections that they're making with other organizations and how they see the fight going forward. They put out a manifesto of sorts that is guiding a lot of their action, and so they're going to be on for Out to Coop Live next week. You'll see a bunch more about that come out in all the regular places. So yes, thank you all for joining us tonight. We'll be back on Friday for our flagship show with Sean Kitchen, and I'm sure we'll be running over whatever the hell happens this week. Let's just keep our fingers crossed that this things don't go too sideways too fast. That gives us an opportunity to catch our breath and make sure that we're kind of operating, kind of clearly moving ahead. pressure, pressure, pressure. That's exactly, Brian. That's where we got to go. So I wish you all the best. I'm glad to hear that some of you, at least, heard from some of you that had a decent holiday. I hope you got some rest. I appreciate every single one of you, and I appreciate you joining us tonight and joining this discussion. For those of you that listen on YouTube, make sure before you go, you're hitting that subscribe button. You're hitting that notification button so you know every time we go live. If you're subscribed to this podcast, if you weren't able to join us live, but you're listening to us in our regular podcast feed, I want you to make sure that you kind of, if you're in iTunes, give us that 5-star review, leave us a review. Wherever you get your podcast, you're on Stitcher, you're on Spotify, you know, you're on Google Podcasts, wherever you, make sure you know, give us that 5-star review. Give us a good review. Write us up there. Let people know your thoughts. That helps other people find us. It only takes a couple minutes, doesn't take a lot of time. And also, look, you get a chance, like, share this show with your friends, right? Kick that out to them. Other folks on the kind of Podbean app who are part of the Podbean Live community, other people in the YouTube community, get that out there and send it to your friends on social media and let them know kind of about the show, and so that we can help continue to grow this in 2021. Well, thanks, everybody. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you being here with me tonight. I think I needed to be with a community like you. So thank you. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. This has been another Out to Coop Live. We've been talking a little about civility, insurrection, and the crisis of democracy here in the U.S. I am your host, and this is the subject, right? This week's is Kevin Mahoney. And do check out our previous shows. We had some great one right before the break with Paris Marks on from the podcast Tech Won't Save Us. It was a great conversation. But we hope to see you online. We hope to see you next week. And take care of yourselves as we get moving forward. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We'll be back Friday with our flagship show, and next Monday for our next Out to Coop Live. Thanks for all joining us all. I leave you with Jonathan Mann. Till then. Try my people to call.